The Right to Speak by Pierre Bourdieu from the book Distinction, a Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste, originally published in 1979. The propensity to speak politically, even in the most rudimentary way, that is, by producing a yes or a no, or putting a cross beside a prefabricated answer, is strictly proportionate to the sense of having the right to speak. Nothing shows this more clearly than the composition of the so-called spontaneous sample of people who responded to a national consultation on the educational system organized with the aid of the press after the events of 1968. In so doing, they asserted themselves as parties to the debate, entitled to express an authorized, authoritative opinion to voice the performative utterance of a legitimate pressure group. The opinion mobilized as if by a petition about education closely coincides with the population of users of higher education. The probability that an isolated agent, in the absence of any delegation, will form an explicit, coherent opinion on the educational system depends on the extent to which he depends on it for his reproduction and is objectively and subjectively interested in its functioning. As if the propensity to influence the destiny of the institution rose with one's importance within it, the rate of response rises with the sense of legitimacy in speaking about it, and with the immediacy of self-interest in its functioning. Thus, the probability of responding, which is much greater for men than for women, the latter tending to write in as parents rather than as authorized spokespersons of a group or the general interest, and for Parisians than for provincials, is, for a given social class, very close to its objective chances of getting its children into one of the grandes écoles, i.e. very close to nil for peasants and manual workers, of the order of 0.09 and 0.05 in 10,000, 0.7 per 10,000 for craftsmen and shopkeepers, 0.9 for clerical workers, 3 for junior executives, 19 for primary teachers, 5 for industrial and commercial employees, 11 for senior executives, 22 for engineers, 26 for members of the professions, 110 for secondary and higher education teachers. These figures are obtained by comparing the male population of each class of respondents with the corresponding fraction of the working population. For pupils and students, who respond more often when at higher levels of study and when enrolled in more prestigious establishments, a lycée rather than a comprehensive or technical school, a grande école rather than a faculty, or when living in Paris than in the provinces, the probability of participation is closely linked to social origin. It is 2 to 3 times greater for the son of an industrialist, a senior executive, or a professional in the case of students, and 6 times greater in the case of pupils. Exactly the same tendencies are seen in the responses to various questions the opinion research institutes have asked about the educational system. In general, there are more don't knows among women than men, for example, in a survey on the government's plans for university reform. 29.7% of women and 25.7% of men in a survey on selection for university interest, 16.9% and 11.2%, but on the question of Latin in secondary schools, 26% of each sex. There are more don't knows among the less educated than among the more highly educated, 32%, 19%, and 35% in response to these 3 questions in the case of those with only primary education, 15%, 6%, and 10% respectively in the case of graduates. There are more don't knows among provincials than Parisians, and steadily more as one moves down the social hierarchy. Thus, the self-selecting spontaneous sample in the national consultation is the limit towards which the population of respondents in a representative survey tends. Or, to put it another way, the answers obtained from a representative sample constitute a spontaneous sample which, although it is not perceived as such, is produced by laws which are fundamentally the same as those described here. Within the spontaneous sample, the less a category is represented, the less its representatives are typical of the category as a whole. And the principle of the bias is almost always their relationship to the educational system. Thus, 90.7% of the industrial and commercial employers have at least the baccalaureate, compared with only 11.3% in the category in the working population. And for the craftsmen and shopkeepers, 28.7% compared with only 2.8%. Similarly, the more remote a fraction is from the educational system, the more those who respond belong to that part of the fraction most interested in the educational system, i.e., those who are of an age to have children in secondary or higher education. Thus, 49.7% of the teachers in the spontaneous sample are aged 35 to 54, 38.9% in the working population, 69.7% of the professionals, 53.5% in the working population, 77.1% of the employees, 50.7% in the working population. It follows from this overselection that the differences between the classes and the fractions, who within the middle and dominant classes are presented in accordance with their cultural capital, are reduced to a minimum, so that the degree of agreement over the problems mentioned is no doubt greater than the population as a whole. If teachers are so strongly overrepresented, this is because they are interested and legitimated on several counts. In fact, the hierarchy of chances of participation show that the effect of legitimacy predominates over the effect of interest due to simple membership. The representation of the different categories of teachers increases as one moves up the hierarchy of institutions. 19 per 10,000 for primary teachers, 34 for CET teachers, 60 for CEG teachers, 199 for LYC teachers, 224 for higher education teachers, and also by rank within each institution, rising from 58 for supply or substitute teachers to 175 for certified teachers, and 382 for agrégés, and from 164 for assistants, junior lecturers, instructors, to 204 for maître assistants, senior lecturers, assistant professors, and 320 for maîtres de conférences, readers, associate professors, and full professors. Agrégés in secondary schools, and especially those who teach the classic subjects, Latin, Greek, French, history, geography, thus respond more readily than any other category. This is no doubt because, while being more legitimate than, for example, primary teachers, who are no less linked to the system, they are more attracted to the system than our university teachers, who can place their investments outside the institution and not only in research, except for those in the most traditional disciplines, French, Latin, Greek, or history, who are much more inclined to respond than those in other disciplines and other faculties. It is perhaps also because more than all other categories, agrégés felt themselves personally called into question by the crisis. If teachers of the disciplines previously dominant in the educational system, Latin, Greek, French, history, were particularly prone to reply, they wrote many books and articles after May 1968. This is also because the redefinition of the legitimate curriculum and legitimate pedagogy, especially in secondary schools, threaten their very existence as producers or reproducers of products which had no other market or raison d'être than secondary education and the competitions for recruitment to it. But the essential lesson of this analysis is that enforcing on everyone uniformly problems which only arise for a few by a procedure as irreproachable as the administration of a questionnaire with preformed answers to a representative sample, there is every likelihood of creating a pure artifact out of thin air. Opinions are made to exist which did not pre-exist the questions, and which otherwise would not have been expressed, or which, if they had been otherwise expressed, i.e. through authorized spokesmen, would have been quite different, opinions which, in any case, had little chance of being formulated spontaneously, of being demonstrated, a demonstration being one way of giving strength to opinions by demonstrating the group which they mobilize. Political opinion is not a purely informative judgment which catches on by the intrinsic force of its truth, but an ID force containing a pretension to become a reality, and the more numerous and powerful the group it mobilizes by its symbolic efficacy, the greater its power of potential enactment. In other words, because it necessarily contains a power to mobilize and a pretension to exist, political opinion is defined not only by its informative content, but also by the social force whereby it exists as a political force, although it is political opinion which helps to make that social force exist by mobilizing the group which contains it in potential form. The authorized speech of status-generated competence, a powerful speech which helps to create what it says, is answered by the silence of an equally status-linked incompetence, which is experienced as technical incapacity and leaves no choice but delegation, a misrecognized dispossession of the less competent by the more competent, of women by men, of the less educated by the more educated, of those who do not know to speak by those who speak well. The propensity to delegate responsibility for political matters to others recognized as technically competent varies in inverse ratio to the educational capital possessed, because the educational qualification and the culture it is presumed to guarantee is tacitly regarded by its holder, but also by others, as legitimate title to the exercise of authority. On the one side, there are those who admit that politics is not for them and abdicate their formal rights for lack of the means of exercising them. On the other, those who feel entitled to claim a personal opinion, or even the authoritative opinion, which is the monopoly of the competent. These two opposed but complementary representations of the division of political labor reproduce the objective division of political powers between the classes and the sexes in dispositions, practices, and discourses, and so help to represent the division itself. And so it is that by one of the paradoxical reversals that are common in such matters, education, which the 19th century reformers expected above all to ensure the proper functioning of universal suffrage by producing citizens capable of voting, we must educate our masters. That's a quote. Now tends to function as a principle of selection, the more effective for not being officially or even tacitly imposed, which supports and legitimates unequal participation in electoral democracy and, tendentially, the whole division of political labor.